Species.
Unite.
Species. Unite.
The alpha female dug a den and had puppies, and we got there as they were squealing in the pack. And what was just amazing is to see how the pack reacted to this. They were so excited. Even when she started digging the den, the other wolves started digging other holes. They weren't helping at all. They were just caught up in it.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. This is Species Unite. We have a favor to ask. If you like today's episode and you have a spare minute, could you please rate and review Species Unite on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts? It really helps people to find the show. I've talked about this before, and I'm going to talk about it a whole lot more. There is a mass slaughter of wolves happening in Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming. This is the first episode in a series that will hopefully get a whole lot more of us to care and then do something to stop this madness before it's too late. And as you will hear in this conversation, there are real things that we can do. But first, we need more people to care. Wolves need as many of us as they can get on their team, and they need us to fight like crazy for them, or in the very near future, they'll be gone. This conversation is with the two people that have made humans care about wolves more than anyone that I know of. Jim and Jamie Dutcher spent 6 years in the 90s living with and filming a pack of wolves called the Sawtooth. And since then, they've focused their lives on the study and documentation of wolf social behavior. Their photographs, books, and Emmy Award-winning films documenting the lives of these remarkable wolves have changed the way that many people see these deeply social and family-oriented animals. Hi, Jamie. Hi, Jim. Thank you both so much for this, for being here. It's awesome.
It's great. Thank you. Great to be with you.
I want to start with the Sawtooth Pack and the work that you did in the 90s that really changed the world for wolves. So can we start there with how it even happened?
We're wildlife filmmakers, and Jamie and I have specialized in animals you rarely get very close to. They're very elusive. From beavers, undersea subjects, mountain lions before wolves, and the wolf being an endangered species, being very elusive and afraid of humans, it was a challenge to make a film that people would care about. So we realized right away, seeing wolves far away, they were so far away that they were just little specks. And I felt that if you wanted to change the way it was for wolves and for people to care, they needed to be able to see into their eyes. Just to explain the project a little bit more is that, you know, we built this enclosure after we raised these puppies and bottle fed them and created the trust. And for the first 3 years of the project, we had our camp outside the enclosure. But we realized that every time we went through the gate, and the wolves would stop doing what they were doing and come over and greet us. So we didn't want to interrupt all this wonderful natural behavior. So we moved our camp into their territory and set up a yurt, a platform, and a sleep tent, and then surrounded it by chain link, not because we were afraid, because they would steal our things.
Yeah, they'd steal stuff.
They'd steal our boots and such. You know, Lewis and Clark had the same problem. They would steal boots from their camp, too. As we slept with these wolves and they were out there, we could see certain behaviors and how they woke up in the morning and how they greeted each other and went from one wolf to another, starting with the alpha. Just all this different behavior.
Yeah, and it's important to note that we had the largest wolf enclosure in the world. And, you know, if we were lucky enough to find a pack of wolves in the wild, and we would have to habituate them to our film gear. And that meant that the next time they saw humans, somebody might be pointing something else at them besides a camera. And that would have been completely irresponsible. So we used a captive pack, and really all behavior studies and social studies done on wolves have been done in enclosures, but very small enclosures of 1 to 3 acres. Like I said, ours was the largest in the world, or 25 acres. This really allowed the wolves to live out their lives. Even though we bottle fed them, they were not pets. If they came, it was on their terms. Everything was very neutral. We never dominated them, and you know, they never tried to dominate us. And that really allowed us to see into their lives and bring that to an audience that that wouldn't see it otherwise.
We started with puppies. We bottle fed them from the moment they opened their eyes so that they would trust us. And we camped with them there in the Sawtooth Mountains for 6 years. When a mountain lion killed one of our wolves, and I witnessed, or we both did, how the pack reacted and how sad they were, that changed me. I realized I probably wasn't a wildlife filmmaker anymore, that my whole life would be about casting a positive light on this misunderstood animal.
And when you talk about when you witnessed their grief, when it was Mataki, right, that died. Will you talk about that and what you witnessed and how that changed you?
The most important thing of this lesson that we learned from this event was how the pack reacted. For the next 6 weeks, they didn't play. Now, anybody watching a pack of wolves would see play probably all the time. Like if an hour went by and you didn't see play, that would be a very unusual hour. They're always pulling tail, chasing each other. They love to find a stick or something and play keep away. But they didn't play for 6 weeks, and they stopped howling the way they usually did. Their howls used to be very energetic with lots of yips and whines, and they would get together and howl as a group. Well, after this happened, they would hardly even stand up to howl. It was a lone howl and very searching. In the way it sounded. About a week or so after, I walked through that territory with the pack with me, and they left me and went over and sniffed the ground. And you could see every wolf in the pack, even the alpha, who has always got his tail up and is pretty perky. His ears went back, his tail went down, and they were sniffing, and they were remembering her. They mourned her. And that's, you know, something we have witnessed. But other biologists have told us stories of where they lost a wolf that they were studying, and the pack would search and figure eight pattern and howl a lot like that, too.
It's heartbreaking. But yeah, it's so important, right, to know this and to see it.
Yeah.
And the same with the play, and the same with the way that some wolves babysit the pups and take care of them. And that everyone always is a kind of watching out for each other. It's a family. It's 100% a family.
And, you know, when you look at your family dog, you know, all dogs are descended from wolves. And, you know, dogs have the same kinds of behaviors. They mourn the loss of, you know, other pets in the family, and they certainly mourn the loss of human family members. So that's where it comes from.
So Beth, we were talking about compassion. Jamie and I have seen this in other places. We were up in Alaska filming wolves, and we went into a fish and game necropsy room where they had the skull of a wolf that had broken its jaw and it healed. And then lived on for quite some time until it was trapped in the fish and game department, had this skull there. And it was interesting to see this broken jaw, yet the wolf lived on for many years. Now, how that happened, the pack had to have brought it food. It wouldn't be able to participate in a kill, and it wouldn't even be able to pull flesh from a carcass. So the pack took care of it.
It's incredible. Yeah. And I have kind of a random aside question. So the 6 years you spent with the sawtooth, that was the first real 6 years of you, your marriage relationship, right? Was that when you guys were first?
Yeah.
That's a really big test.
We knew each other before, but then we really dived in.
That really could have gone one of two ways.
Yeah.
I mean, you lived in a wolf enclosure for 6 years. That's love. That's awesome.
It'll make or break you.
Yeah. What was it like when it ended? I mean, it must have been so just shocking to everything in your system when it was over. You know, that's what you did every day and who you were surrounded by. And now you're like, what, you go back to the real world?
Yeah, it was heartbreaking. The project was conducted on Forest Service land. And we renewed our permits until we could no longer renew them. And we knew that at the end of the project, we'd have to find a permanent home for the wolves. So we talked to the Nez Perce tribe in northern Idaho, and we built a similar situation there on Nez Perce tribal land so the wolves could continue to live out their lives. And we had trained caregivers to go with them as well to live there. It was heartbreaking. It was like giving up your kids.
When Moxie followed me to the gate and then just curled up and laid there like I'll wait until you come back, I just broke my heart.
Yeah.
You know, we tried to go up there as often as possible and see them.
And how were they when you would visit?
Oh, excited. Really excited.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They jump all over us. We took a crew from CBS up there one time after we hadn't seen them and turned them over to the tribe. And they were out in the field, snow was falling, and we didn't know how they would treat us. And we called Kamatsa's name, and he just lit up. And the whole pack came running towards us and jumped up on us and licked our faces and where have you been?
That's almost more heartbreaking, right?
Yeah, it was hard. I mean, to this day, if I'm sleeping and suddenly I hear like big wind gusts coming through, I panic because I worry about trees on the enclosure fence, and I'm like, wait a minute, it's not there anymore. And you know, it's just it's a hard thing. And you know, every time you know you hear a hard rain, you know, the memory goes back to, you know, raindrops on a tent, that sound, and it's just with us all the time.
And, you know, we write books about the wolves, quite a few of them, and we're writing one now. And every time we recycle these stories, it brings up a lot of emotions. It was the most important thing that I ever did in my life.
Well, both of us, I think.
Yeah.
But, all the pack members have passed away. And really, you know, we tell their stories and continue to try to get people to understand wolves now more than ever. Yeah, so
they become
their memory lives on.
Ambassadors, and their stories live on.
Well, and their stories are so full of life that, you know, just me, I had read them a long time ago, and this week rereading, like, they're so alive. And and you do fall in love with everybody. Like,
the climax of the whole story is that the eureka moment was when the pack mated themselves, you know, the alpha male and the alpha female. There's only two wolves in a pack that normally mate. And if there is not enough prey in the area, they won't mate at all. So the alpha female dug a den and had puppies. And we got there as they were squealing in the pack. And what was just amazing is to see how the pack reacted to this. They were so excited. Even when she started digging the den, the other wolves started digging other holes. They weren't helping at all. they were just caught up in it.
That is awesome.
So Jamie and I arrived there early in the morning, and we could hear the squeals of the newborn pups coming from the den. And we had talked about this after filming for a while and seeing the pack all excited. As the hours went by, we felt everything was calm. And Jamie went over to the den, kneeled down, and the alpha female came out and sat right with her. And just like, you know, what do you think? And Jamie pulled out of her pocket a flashlight and showed it to Shamook. And she sniffed it. And then Jamie got down on her belly and crawled into the den. And the, the den was amazing, with roots coming down, and how she navigated up around the big boulders and roots into a chamber. And instead of finding the little pups on the floor of the den, they were up on a shelf. She kept them high and dry. You know, it was really slushy and wet outside, but everything inside this den was bone dry. And she saw the pups, they heard her, and then she started to back out. And when she got out again, the alpha female licked her on the nose, licked Jamie on the nose, and then went back to see her puppies. It was absolute trust. Yeah. You know, Jamie had raised that female from birth, and she had a bond with her.
Well, and she wanted to show them off to you too, right?
Like, yeah. I mean, the other wolves weren't allowed in the den, so I felt very honored.
You saw them before any of the other wolves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Oh my God.
No wolf went into that den, but she let me go in. And I was ready to get bit on the rear end. That was going to be my badge of honor.
That is so cool.
And you can imagine, you just couldn't do this in the wild, because the wolves are so afraid. If you went close to a den, they may desert it and leave. But they trusted us. And it was the only way to make a film that people would care about this animal. You know, and that's what we were trying to do, is to show a emotional side to these animals.
Well, and in so many ways, I mean, not only in their actions and their relationships do you make us care, and like you said, their eyes, but also their expressions. Mm-hmm. I mean, they really, like, the joy when it snows and like how their bodies express themselves. It's very similar to our expressions, right?
Yeah.
So
they're very
you
expressive
feel it
and
when
emotional.
You're seeing it. Yeah, for sure.
When the pack was gathered around the opening of the den, they would kind of walk stiff-legged, like almost on tiptoes.
Going from one foot to the other, side by side, like, oh, we're so excited.
and they would lean against each other, shoulder to shoulder, and they would vocalize in a way that, you know, we called it their Chewbacca language from Star Wars. Like, oh, 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 oh. I don't know what they were saying.
Wow. And speaking of vocalizations, like with their howling, why do they howl?
Oh, gosh. You know, we like to say wolves howl for more reasons than we'll ever know. It's the iconic vocalization that everybody thinks about with wolves. But like we've said, they have so many more vocalizations that people don't hear, you know. But, you know, they'll howl after a good meal. They'll howl to gather each other together, to gather together as a group. They'll howl to see who's out there. And just joyously, they'll howl. They will not always howl at the full moon.
Okay. Good to know.
The moon may be full when they are howling, but they don't howl for the full moon. But you know, just from regular howls to bark howls if they're upset or distressed, you know, the whines, the yips, the very quiet vocalizations, the Chewbacca sounds that we call them. It's really an extensive, crazy combination of sounds.
Jamie was able to put her microphone outside the tent and then run the cable into where we had our bunk, and she would have her tape recorder right with her in bed. And so when they start to howl in the middle of the night, she was there. And there was one wolf who was very aloof. He was a pup of the third generation of pups that we raised there. And he was very aloof during the day. But at night, he seemed to get comfort in being as close to us as possible. And so with us in the bunk, the tent right next to our heads, and the chain length a few inches from that, he was really about 2 feet away. And you could hear him roll over and moan and such. But when the other wolf started to howl from a distance, and he started to howl, it would launch us right out of bed.
Oh, I can't imagine.
It was like he was under the bed. It's like, ow.
That's
it was like
amazing.
Being in a drum. Yeah, it was. Yeah.
What a gift that you gave the world, but what a gift those 6 years were to you well.
Yeah, those wolves gave us so much.
We went on to tell their story and did presentations around the nation and even overseas, to Europe and Jordan and South America. We the story of the sawtooth back has been very much appreciated. That makes us feel really good about what we did.
Well, so while you were doing this, the wolves were reintroduced during the same time, right? Am I right on that?
That's right, yeah.
And so wolf hatred had already begun, or I guess it's been going on for hundreds of years, but this new version of it, the modern day wolf hatred, I guess. Did that affect you and your project, just the anti-wolf people?
In fact, we met with biologists from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and they thought a wolf film coming out just before wolves were reintroduced would be a fantastic idea, to educate people about this animal before it was released to Yellowstone National Park and Central Idaho.
But at the same time, we would get hate mail in the mailbox. We would get threatening phone calls, move the wolves or we will. You tried not to take it too seriously, but the anger was visceral.
Yeah.
As wolf reintroduction was becoming more and more of a reality, people were more and more angry.
We were so afraid of somebody throwing poison into the pack or shooting through the fence that we actually took the precaution of hiring a company from Montana out of state to come and put up the original enclosure. So we just didn't want locals to know where this wolf pack was. And good friends would say, I want to go see, but it would really upset them. We said, we can't.
Because even though we were on Forest Service land, we were surrounded by private land. Okay. So you could, ranchers. Unless you were trespassing on the ranchers' land, you couldn't get to us. And there were, there were trespassers. People did find us, but everything seemed to.
Yeah.
Right. It feels like and seems like everything is worse right now for wolves, especially Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming. Is that true? Or
not having experienced the extermination of wolves firsthand when it finally ended, I can't say. But what I can speak to now is the incredible anger and uncontrollable hate that people have, not only for wolves, but for the federal government. The federal government reintroduced wolves, and I hate the federal government, so I hate wolves. It really makes no sense. And when people talk to us about why there is such a hate for wolves, it's really difficult to explain because it doesn't come from any kind of a point of reality. The reality is that, wolves account for less than 1% of all livestock predation. And the majority of livestock are on the open range, which is owned by all of us, not ranchers. And, you have other issues, lightning strikes, illness, other predators, domestic dogs,
weather,
animals being hit on the highway, all account for more livestock loss than wolves. And, you know, this idea that, you know, wolves are killing all the deer and elk, you know, that hunters like to hunt. Well, you know, wolves hunt to sustain themselves. And the idea of wolves hunting for sport is ridiculous. One kick from a elk or a moose or, you know, gore from an antler, and that wolf is dead. And 9 times out of 10, they miss. Right. And they only, they generally hunt, you know, every 5 to 7 days, depending on how big the animal is. They take the weakest, the sickest animals, and, you know, we're human beings, take the prize animals. Wolves and their prey have lived together forever, you know, and have never decimated, wolves have never decimated the populations. And this idea that, you know, a hunter might say, well, you know, I used to go to the same place every time to, you know, to get my elk, and it's not there anymore. Well, wolves are doing what wolves are meant to do. They're the only predators in North America that keep ungulate herds, deer, elk, moving, because right. that's not only good for the ungulates, it's good for the health of the land. So you might have a guy who went to the same spot every year and they're not there anymore, but they're over the next hill where right. some poor guy who was never able to get an elk now can get one. So it actually takes, you know, hunting skill. You actually have to look for your animal.
It's not fair chase anymore.
Yeah, it's not.
You know, they're using bait.
Yeah.
Traps.
Now, yeah, traps.
They're being paid bounties for dead wolves. They're allowed to hunt at night with night vision scopes.
They're talking about aerial hunting.
Yeah.
Now, you know, what I was talking about was just the general hate of wolves from right. the myth. But what's going on now is just such an unbelievable slaughter of a senseless slaughter for no reason.
And will you talk about, I read this in your books, but when you hunt wolves and they're slaughtered and packs get broken up, right? How much worse that is for the wolves, of course, but for everyone else too, the prey, the livestock.
Yeah. If you have a pack of wolves, maybe 10, 12 wolves, and you kill them, and we have observed any perceived danger, the alpha usually steps up and checks out what's happening, what's coming into their territory, and they're the first to be shot. And you break up packs that are a dozen or so into small little groups of twos and threes. Well, those two or three wolves really have a hard time bringing down a large ungulate like an elk. And usually if they have pups, one of those three will have to stay back with the newborn. And so they can't bring down the elk or deer. So they go after what is easier to feed upon. So really shooting wolves is making it worse for ranchers.
There's a lot of things that, like, just actual facts and numbers, like they only kill so many livestock, or this whole thing about when you break up a pack, how much worse it is. Like, yeah. It's just numbers and facts, but it feels like no one believes them. That's anti-wolf.
Well, yeah, we're living in the age of alternative facts and misinformation. Right. No, people generally like to believe what they want to believe. And, you know, it's sort of like, you know, one of the big myths about wolf reintroduction is that the wolves that were captured in Canada and reintroduced to Yellowstone National Park in central Idaho was this giant, supersized wolf, 300-pound wolf. And it, you know, doesn't belong here. Well, okay. The last time I checked, there is not a wall that separates the United States from Canada. These are the same wolves. They go back and forth and back and forth. And, you know, and it's like, you know, when you have a conversation with somebody who says something like that, and you're like, well, wait a minute. You know, so how does that happen? They just stop at the border and they're like, oh, yeah. You know, it's like if they took the time to actually think about it, you know, it doesn't make sense. And it's really a shame, because the reintroduction of wolves has been so good for the landscape. And, yeah. You know, nowhere can you see that better than Yellowstone National Park. Before wolf reintroduction, you had so many elk. They were all over the place. And yeah, it was fun for people to see crazy herds of elk. But they were hanging out in the riparian areas along the rivers and streams and just browsing down every new growth of willow, aspen, everything. It was devastated. Well, when wolves were introduced into the park, they call it the ecology of fear. Suddenly, elk had to kind of watch their backs. So rather than hanging out in those riparian areas that are so delicate, they're more a little more up on the hillsides where they can see what's going on. And that's allowed willows to grow back, aspens to come back, which has made the water cooler. So it's made the trout population better. Songbirds have come back. Rodents that feed, you know, small animals and birds of prey. It's just everything is better because of wolves. But with wolves gone, you kind of got used to seeing something that was not natural. And here's a cool fact. Pronghorn antelope are not preyed upon by wolves. They just don't bother. They're too fast. They don't even go after the calves. But they are hunted by coyotes.
Okay.
So
they specialize in feeding on the newborns.
Yeah, on the newborns. So pronghorn antelope will seek out areas where wolves are to give birth, to keep them safe, because coyotes won't go near wolves.
That is so amazing.
Yeah. So the pronghorn population goes up and where they had been faltering. So it's all good. It's, you know, it's the trophic cascade, the top down and the bottom up. It all works together, where wolves are one of those keystone species that, you know, hold everything together.
So now you can hunt wolves year-round here.
In Idaho.
And we have more cattle and sheep in this state than we do people. But visitors don't come here to see cattle and sheep. No. And there are 2.5 million cattle and sheep. And wolves have killed only 173 of them in a year. You know, it's such a small percentage, and they are reimbursed. The ranches are reimbursed by the states for any loss to wolves.
I mean, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
No.
I know, it doesn't.
And is the hatred, is it also fear?
Yeah, it's that myth. I mean, you know, when wolves were first reintroduced, I can't remember the name of the town. They had, you know, the school bus stop where the kids wait for the school bus. They like surrounded it. They made it a cage because they were afraid wolves were going to come and eat the children.
Oh, come on.
I mean, it is completely insane. Completely insane. There's never been, there's been one possible documented death caused by a wolf.
Two. In 120 years.
Yeah, in 120 years. And and that usually had to do with like habituation to a garbage dump and, you know, things like that, things that are like unnatural. Wolves are terribly afraid of people. They're very curious of us. And if you are in the wild and you are actually lucky enough to see a wolf, it's only because they want you to see them. Otherwise, you won't. And it's just, it's a shame what we're doing to the mother of all dogs.
It's a national treasure.
Yeah.
You know, so many people go to Yellowstone and to see wolves. And right. And now the wolves are leaving the park, as they always do, to follow the elk. And now the government of Montana has taken away the buffer zones that were close to the border. You're only allowed to kill one wolf per zone. They took away that protection. And now Yellowstone has lost about 20% of their wolves.
It's tragic.
It's devastating. It's completely devastating. Most wolves are on public land, correct?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And public land is owned by everybody in this country.
Yes.
So it feels like we would have more say than we do now.
Yeah, that's the biggest issue. Is like when we do our presentations around the country, and you get somebody like in New York who says, "Well, you know, those wolves are out west. What can I do?" And it's like, you know, you have to remember, these wolves, for the most part, are living on federal land, your land. They were reintroduced with your tax dollars. You have a say, and the states don't want to hear it. You know, if they get a comment period and they get stuff from out of state, they'll throw it out. But you really have to be vocal. You can't sit back and go, well, you know, it's not my state, because they are your wolves.
So who are you being vocal to?
The federal government. Yeah. And still the state governments, I mean, you know, flooding them with letters they don't want to see is always a good thing. But, you know, it gets to be a pain in their neck. But really, for any change to happen, it's lost in the states. It's going to have to come from the federal level. So to put wolves back on the endangered species list for the short term, until they can get a better plan, a better protection plan, not only for wolves, but also other predators, you know, a predator protection act. So they're not treated as vermin, but as important functioning pieces to a healthy ecosystem. That's the only way we're really going to get anywhere. And there are also ways to punish the states who have indiscriminate killing of wolves. States receive quite a lot of funds from the federal government. And some of those funds come with strings attached to protecting the natural world, the environment, and wild spaces, and that they're not doing that. Okay. And so, you know, that funding can be pulled. Could be pulled.
So on your website, is there like a place to go to learn more about
Yes, there is. Okay. Yeah, how you can help living with wolves. .org, and there's addresses of all the fish and game departments in the western states, and governors' phone numbers and senators, and all that is listed right there.
Awesome. And you know, writing letters really, you know, some people say, "Oh, no one's ever going to see my letter." It really does help. Writing the Interior Department, writing Deb Haaland, you know, President Biden, just everybody. They need to hear what people really think, because it's a minority. It's an American minority that is anti-wolf.
They're just really loud and really effective.
They're very loud.
Right.
Yeah, like the gun lobby.
The two of you have for years have been giving presentations and talking to large groups of people about this. Are the majority of the people that come hear you talk already pro-wolf, or are you changing minds while you're doing this as well? Do ranchers or anybody like that show up?
Yes, I'm glad you asked that. Yes. No, I would have to say the majority of people that do come to our presentations are pro-wolf. But the amount of people who are anti-wolf or on the fence is pretty amazing. And when we give a presentation and somebody comes up to us and says, you know, I always wanted to kill a wolf and I can't now. I didn't know they were family animals. It's like, that's it. That's the most gratifying. It's great when you see the army of people that are there to help you. But when you get new recruits that were on the other side, that's pretty terrific.
Or kids that we talked to a decade ago who will write to us. And this has happened quite often lately. They'll write to us and say, you know, you took the time to talk to me and I saw your presentation. And I just want you to know that I'm graduating from college in wildlife management, and it was you that inspired us.
Or wolf biology.
Cool.
And it's happening, you know, four or five times since the beginning of the year.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I love it. Well, Jim and Jamie, thank you for this, but thank you also for, I mean, the past 40 years of what you've done for
thanks.
The wolves. And it's awesome.
To learn more about Jim and Jamie Dutcher and to learn more about wolves, go to our website, speciesunite.com. We will have links to everything. I'd like to thank Jamie Dutcher for letting us use her wolf recordings. She won a Primetime Emmy for sound in their films. We are on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. If you have a spare moment and could do us a favor, please subscribe, rate, review Species Unite on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps people find the show. If you'd like to support Species Unite, we would greatly appreciate it. Go to our website, speciesunite.com, and click donate. I'd like to thank everyone at Species Unite, including Gary Knudsen, Caitlin Pierce, Amy Jones, Paul Healy, Santina Polke, Bethany Jones, and Anna Kallner, who wrote and performed today's music. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day.